This is KUOW 94.9 Seattle News and Information. Hi, I'm Bill Radke. Thank you for tuning in today. You probably shouldn't drink that Dr. Pepper. It's not good for you, but if you're going to drink it, you might as well help some kids. That's how the city figures a new tax on sugary sodas being proposed by the mayor. He wants to put a 2 cents per ounce tax on the distributors who sell those kinds of drinks to stores and spend that money on reducing the disparities between white and non-white students. Do you want the city to charge that tax? Is this wise? Are the health benefits overrated? We're going to help you decide now with my guests, Dr. Jim Krieger of the group Healthy Food America, who teaches public health at the University of Washington School of Medicine. Hi, Doc.
Hey, good afternoon.
Food lawyer and George Mason University law professor, Balin Lenikin. Professor, thanks for coming today.
Thanks very much.
Welcome to Seattle.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
Jim, you start out with the fact that sugary sodas are insidiously damaging to our health. Will you tell us about that?
Yeah, the evidence is quite clear and rock solid at this point that consuming excessive amounts of sugary drinks, whether they're sports drinks, energy drinks, fruit drinks, or soda, is linked to increased rates of diabetes, heart disease, liver disease, and obesity, and tooth decay.
Balin, would you agree that a soda tax would make people any healthier?
No, I don't think so. I think that regardless of whether soda is good or bad for you, I think that taxing soda is not something that's actually going to be linked to increased health outcomes, better health outcomes. And I think that most soda tax advocates even are careful to not to claim that, say, Seattle residents, for example, would lose 2 pounds thanks to the tax.
Okay. Separate from, we'll get into the question maybe of how we behave when we're taxed, but how do you feel even about the health dangers of sugary sodas?
I'm a food lawyer. I have a background in law, and I tend not to comment on the healthfulness or non-healthfulness of particular foods. I think that if you look at consumers across America, we all eat and drink differently. Some people eat vegan. Some people keep kosher. Some people are paleo. They can't all be wrong. They can't all be right. But I think that people can practice varied diets and still be healthy.
Jim, Bernie Sanders said that soda taxes are regressive because poor people drink more soda. He's not the only one. He's just a famous name. What do you say to that idea? It's a regressive tax.
I think a soda tax is a progressive policy. And the reason I say it's a progressive policy is that when you take the revenues from a soda tax and invest them in low-income communities to improve education, to improve access to early learning, to improve access to healthy foods, to prevent diabetes, then there's a net transfer of money, of wealth, from rich to poor, and those ultimately are going to benefit those communities. So it's a net progressive policy. We also know that the diseases caused by sugary drinks, and I disagree with you, the evidence is rock solid. It doesn't matter if you're a paleo or a vegan. If you drink soda, you're going to increase your risk of diabetes. These diseases are regressive, meaning that low-income people suffer a great and undue burden from diabetes and heart disease and poor teeth. And so by reducing consumption of these, the tax will benefit their health, and so there'll be a win-win in their health and also in more resources for their communities.
Balin, before you say more about regressive versus progressive, do you want to say anything about what Jim is saying that, wait a minute, there's no question that soda is bad for you? I want to make sure that you get a chance to explain where you are even on that question.
Sure. I mean, again, as a lawyer, I'm not a health expert, but I am an expert on the idea that certain taxes that are allegedly supposed to improve our health won't necessarily do so. We can look at, say, a lottery. The lottery was supposed to make education so much better, but essentially it's operated as a tax on the poor. It hasn't necessarily benefited low-income consumers, learners, and the people you see in line at the lottery counter are usually low-income consumers who are essentially giving the state their money in the same way that those buying soda would be doing.
Would you think of this soda tax as being more regressive, a hit on lower income people who tend to drink more of this soda? Or do you see the progressiveness of it as shifting it to people who could most use those programs?
I certainly understand the argument in the latter case, so that it's more progressive. I disagree with it, but I can recognize that argument. I think that when we look at whether it's a progressive tax, whether it's going to somehow benefit low income consumers, taking money from them that they might otherwise use to, say, buy kale or celery or spend at the farmer's market is not necessarily going to improve their health outcomes. It's going to leave them with less money to buy.
Well, actually, if you look at the data, what will happen is low-income people will spend less money net on soda and sugary drinks after a tax goes into effect. Therefore, they'll have more money to spend on fruits and vegetables or whatever else they choose to spend it on. We also know that nobody has to buy soda. Nobody has to pay the tax. So for both those reasons, actually, a tax will end up giving low-income people more money in their pocket to buy healthier foods if they so choose.
I think that's a sugar-free pie in the sky.
No, actually, the evidence data and the tax models and the economic simulation models demonstrate that quite clearly.
Simulations and models can demonstrate lots of different things, and economists have a way of showing us that mm-hmm. up is down and down is up.
Balin, what about the fact that this tax excludes diet drinks and Frappuccinos, for example? Does that matter to you?
Not particularly. I mean, I think that the government shouldn't be in the business of skewing our food choices in any particular mm-hmm. way. And so, you know, this tax excludes diet beverages. It excludes very, very high sugar drinks like orange juice, which doesn't have added sugar, but does have a ton of natural sugar contained in it. And so, you know, if in fact this is, as it appears to have done elsewhere, shifting people from buying more expensive soda X to less expensive soda Y, or to drinking things like orange juice that have almost as much soda as...
I'd be curious to hear the data you base that statement on, because the actual real-world data that we have from Mexico, which is the best-studied case now, show that after imposition of the tax, bottled water and mm-hmm. water products went up, sugary drink products went down. There was no net effect on juice or other groceries. So I think there's no evidence to say that folks are actually shifting to less healthier, cheaper products. Sugary drink consumption is down in Mexico. It's down in Berkeley after the tax, and water consumption is up. So people are making the smart choice.
I do take the point that models and analogies are they're hard to rely on.
But these are real data from the real world. This is actual 2 years worth of data on spending in Mexico after a tax is in effect.
Could I chime in? Mm-hmm. The data also shows that the consumption of soda has actually increased since that initial decrease, and it also shows that the soda consumption outside of Berkeley in San Francisco and Oakland has increased. And so it probably means. And again, the data is not as rigid
actually,
as we'd like.
Mailin, that the soda, most recent data.
Let me finish,
yeah,
please.
Sure, I'm sorry. Yeah.
That soda consumption in, you know, people essentially are moving to other places to buy their, you know, they're going to Costco and outside of the town, which would presumably happen here, rather than simply not buying it.
But, well, couple questions out of this. Yeah. For one, does it make it a more regressive tax, Jim, when it doesn't fall on diet drinks, given that higher income people tend to go for diet drinks compared to sugary drinks?
I think the issue with diet drinks is we don't really know what their long-term health effects are. Some people can lose weight short-term if they consume diet drinks in placement of full-calorie sodas, but we don't know the health effects. So from a public policy point of view, if you want strong scientific evidence on which to base a policy like a tax, we don't have enough evidence to know if diet sodas are good or bad.
And what about taxing fruit juices? Is fruit sugar that much better for you?
We actually are going to be publishing later this week in the journal Pediatrics a study looking at fruit juice. And there's no evidence that fruit juice is associated with significant amounts of weight gain in kids, for example. So you can't, again, make the same case about fruit juice having the same effects, which are so clear with sugary drinks like soda, energy drinks, sports drinks, that are linked to weight gain, diabetes, and other problems.
Balin, you think that a soda tax is a kind of slippery slope, right? To other foods. To explain that.
Yeah, it's well on its way down the slippery slope. So, I mean, in addition to opposing soda taxes, I've opposed raw milk bans. I've opposed restrictions on farmers markets. I've opposed California's foie gras ban. I mean, this is simply a way of the government taking more money from consumers or restricting choices and trying to divert, choices into this sort of smaller and smaller funnel. And when we restrict choices, as we know in other areas with speech and religion and whatnot, consumers and Americans and taxpayers are worse off.
Well, first of all, this is a delicious slippery slope. This is one of the most tasty. This is slippery with vegetable oil. But why shouldn't we tax bacon, for example, if it's bad for us? You know, analogous to sodas.
Right, but again, it goes back to who decides. You know, does the American Pork Producers Council decide if bacon is healthy or unhealthy for us? Do public health advocates? Do lawmakers? And do consumers? You know, who ultimately is right about whether bacon is healthy? And is there one right answer?
Do you have any ethical qualms about, influencing through taxation what people decide to put in their bodies, Jim?
No, I think that it's very important that people know what's healthy for them and what can cause them harm. It's clear that sugary drinks cause harm. By putting a tax on a product and labeling it as harmful, not only does it raise revenue for supporting low-income communities, but it sends an important public message out. It's an important vehicle for public education to say this product is being taxed because it's going to cause you harm.
Balin, you have said that you want to improve education. I mentioned at the top that Seattle's mayor wants the money raised to go to pay for programs that would reduce disparities among white and non-white students. And you've said these taxes aren't the answer. What is the answer?
Well, I think the answer, something that we could redirect money both at the federal level and locally. One thing that we do, which is completely inane and which I suspect, Jim, you probably would agree with, is that we subsidize the sweeteners. You know, we pay farmers to grow corn and we protect sugar tariff, you know, sugar makers and refiners with tariffs. And so get rid of the subsidies for farmers who grow, you know, corn and soy and other things that get corn in particular gets turned into high fructose corn syrup. Why are we essentially, pardon the indelicate language, screwing consumers twice, taxpayers twice, by taxing them once to pay farmers to grow stuff and then taxing them again for buying the things that those farmers grew because we encouraged them? Why not use that money for education?
Any final thoughts from you, Jim?
Yeah, I mean, I think on that point, I think I would agree with you on that policy. However, the tariffs and the subsidies change the price of a consumer product only by a few pennies. It's inconsequential, whereas a tax on sugary drinks is going to raise a lot more revenue for these important purposes. And so coming back to it, I think it's, do we want to support things that are important in our community, like access to pre-K, to education? And a sugary drink tax is a great way to do it because it puts a tax on a product that is harmful, has no nutritional value, and redirects resources from wealthier communities to low-income communities to make that happen.
Again, this proposal would be expected to raise $16 million a year. This is a Seattle tax on the distributors of sodas, so it's not a sales tax right at the register. It includes sodas and energy and sports drinks and pre-sweetened teas and coffees and some fruit drinks, but exempts 100% fruit juice and in-store coffee beverages that you get from your barista and other stuff too, a 2 cent per tax per ounce on distributors. And we're going to continue talking about the pros and cons of this. I really appreciate both of you helping us think it through. Thank you.
Okay,
thanks
thank
so
you.
Much.
We've been talking here with Dr. Jim Krieger of the group Healthy Food America, also at the University of Washington School of Medicine, and food lawyer and George Mason University law professor Balin Lineken. And more to come on soda taxes here on KUOW Seattle. And more of The Record to come as well. I hope you can stay tuned.
Maybelline, why can't you be true? Oh, Maybelline, why can't
you? Yeah, he died over the weekend. Chuck Berry passed away. And coming up on the program, we are going to hear a little more music. But we're going to hear from music writer Chuck Klosterman, author of But What If We're Wrong? And he says, if there was one rock and roller on Earth, one who could represent rock and roll music to aliens, then that earthling rock and roller is Chuck Berry. That's coming up in a little less than 30 minutes on KUOW. Stick around.
You done started back doing the thing you used to do. A Cadillac pulled up to 104, before it got hot and wouldn't do no more.
Seattle has such a proud Native American history. We are the only major city named for a Native American chief. Local shops and galleries sell thousands of dollars worth of Native-themed arts and crafts every year. But a lot of that stuff isn't made by Native Americans, and that is against the law, as KUOW's arts and culture reporter Marcy Silman tells us.
Last year, almost 500,000 tourists sailed into Seattle on cruise ships, and many of them found their way here to the Pike Place Market.
Thank you for coming.
The Steinbrook Gallery is just up the street from the totem poles that overlook Elliott Bay. The gallery offers an array of silver jewelry, wood carvings, and other fine art, including colorful contemporary paintings by a Northwest artist.
His name is Tlaquaguila Steve Smith. He's one of my favorites.
Co-curator Nathan Germain says the gallery specializes in work by Native American artists like Smith.
All of our labels and gallery tags specifically mention the nation, the culture, or the tribe that the artist belongs to, and that's intentional.
It's also the law.
If we did deal with a non-Native artist doing Native artwork, we would declare them as non-Indigenous or non-Native.
The Native American art trade is regulated by a federal law called the Indian Arts and Crafts Act. Seattle attorney Gabe Galanda says Congress originally passed this law back in the 1930s.
It was really designed to encourage and promote Indian arts and crafts and to promote the Indian artist.
Congress wanted the law to foster economic development on Indian reservations. It also fostered a multi-million dollar industry, and a lot of non-natives wanted a piece of that pie. By the end of the 20th century, they were manufacturing and selling a slew of fake Indian products, everything from rugs and jewelry to ersatz Native masks. So Congress revised the act in 1990.
Really, the goal of the 1990 amendments was to really enforce this law against non-Indians who would perpetrate fraud by misappropriating Indian arts and crafts, or in fact counterfeiting Indian art or craft.
More than 600 art fraud claims have been filed since 2006. Initially, these cases go to a board that oversees compliance with the law.
But the board doesn't have the resources that it needs to answer all those complaints.
Attorney Gabe Galanda.
And then once they're referred, the FBI, especially post 9/11, has diverted its resources elsewhere to anti-terrorism. They're not focused on fake, you know, Zuni jewelry in the Southwest like they could or should be under the law.
Galanda and other advocates would love to see some kind of government-issued documentation that authenticates Native-made art. Alaska already issues a special seal called the Silver Hand to art made by Native Alaskans. Steinbrook Gallery curator Nathan Germain's part of a new group called the Washington Indian Arts and Crafts Project. He says they'd like to see something similar here.
They're looking to start a program where galleries or shops or museums would work together with artists and would have a certification program in place.
Seattle hasn't seen any major Native art fraud investigations yet, but Nathan Germain says plenty of stores here use the term Native-inspired to label non-Native made goods. That hurts Native artists, but it also could mislead consumers.
Somebody who really actually wants to look to buy something authentic, they need to ask questions. The most important thing about that is to actually find out the person who crafted the work. That's really vital.
Germain says if you think you're getting an unbelievable deal on Native art, it may be the Native art that's unbelievable. In the Pike Place Market, I'm Marcy Silman, KUOW News.
And tomorrow, Marcy's going to be reporting on the murky area between the letter of the law and the ongoing problem of cultural appropriation. This is The Record on KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke. Let's talk now about President Trump's first proposed budget, because it really landed hard among local politicians when it came out last week. The King County executive called it an assault on the environment and economy. Seattle's mayor called it downright dangerous, putting the economy and human lives at risk. Well, today, the Seattle City Council got together to learn more about what the president's budget ideas could mean for Seattle. KUOW's Paige Browning covers City Hall. Hey, Paige.
Hey, Bill.
Will you first remind us of the funding Seattle government would lose if this federal budget were to be approved?
Yeah, and just to remind you, the simple summary of the federal budget is that more money would go to defense spending, so there will be cuts in a lot of other areas to make that happen.
Mm-hmm.
How would it hit Seattle? It would impact funding for arts programs. It would impact funding for local transit programs, including things like bus rapid transit. But here are three of the big ones that city leaders are concerned about: environmental cleanup, housing, and homeless services. If I can detail those a little, on environment, a vast amount of the money for Puget Sound restoration comes from the federal government. So city and state leaders are very concerned that we're not going to have money to do things like clean up beaches, clean up areas where there are shellfish beds and we're harvesting shellfish from.
Mm-hmm.
As far as housing and homelessness, the proposed federal budget would take away about $4 million in funds used to create affordable housing in Seattle. So the city does things like buy up buildings that otherwise would be sold to developers, and the city turns them into affordable housing. They just did one last month. Money to be able to buy those things would be possibly taken off the table.
Okay. And again, Seattle City Council was getting together today with a federal liaison official, I guess, and they're talking about what all this would mean and also what they could do about it. Paige, what did they come up with as far as any action plan ideas?
Yeah, well, the one thing they can do at this point is lobby the federal government, and that's what they'll be doing. City officials will be lobbying to say, keep money in the budget for affordable housing and for homeless services and for environmental cleanup. We don't know the details of the federal budget. We're supposed to see a more full version come out in May. Until then, it's kind of educated guess as to what might they see cut. And what does the city need to prepare for when it creates its budget in the fall?
It's going to be so interesting to see how local governments, as you say, lobby for their priorities and how all of this gets actually worked out through Congress.
Mm-hmm.
That's Paige Browning, who covers Seattle City Hall for us. Paige, thanks for catching us up to on today's meeting.
Thanks, Bill.
You're listening to The Record, KUOW 94.9 Seattle. We talked a little about housing there, along with homelessness and the environment, and we're going to talk about a prescription for homelessness in just a moment. And I mean, in this case, literally a prescription. Stay tuned. So as Paige Browning was just telling you, Seattle is trying to sort out its problem with homelessness. Meanwhile, the highest per capita homeless rate in America, that's in Hawaii, where ER doctor Josh Green has a close-up view. Chronically homeless people visiting his emergency room over and over for the same issues. Dr. Green wants to be able to prescribe some of those people a place to live. Yeah, prescribe a home. He has proposed a law to let doctors do that, which he can do because he's also a Hawaii state senator. Green told me why a medical home prescription would save lives and money.
Over the years, I've seen people 30, 40, 50 times in my ER. They're suffering very badly. They don't have a home too often. They certainly have these other comorbidities of mental illness and drug addiction. And we just weren't doing well by them. They were getting a little care, but the budget was exploding. We can't take care of anybody else practically because there's not much resource left over. And I began to turn to other people in our state for solutions. And that's when Helping Hands Hawaii stepped up and said, look, Josh, we've already studied this here. We found that the moment you put a roof over somebody's head, their health care costs drop 43% in Hawaii. I heard it's 55% in Seattle.
How would your idea work then, getting housing to some patients?
You know, first thing that people bring up is, how do you know you got the right people, that people aren't going to game the system? Well, the funny part about that is, if you ask myself or any of my colleagues who see the individuals, we know the people who are suffering by first name, middle name, and last name, because we've seen them so often, and we really care for them, but we can't help them yet with our current system. So a doctor would see a patient. They would have already been well into the system. They're on Medicaid. You know, they've been diagnosed many times, numerous times with these issues. They're clearly homeless. We would work with Human Services Department to make sure we verified that. So they're homeless for more than 6 months. They would only meet the criteria if they also were suffering from drug addiction or mental illness. And then it would be like anything else. A doc would write a prescription, would say, this individual needs housing. It would go to the insurance company that's managing the Medicaid contract, and they would make sure that it was appropriate. Now, people will next say, are you really going to let Dr. Green out there write an $1,800 a month prescription for housing? Well, look, they let me write a prescription for $145,000 for hepatitis C. But, of course, they check to make sure the person actually has hepatitis C, that they have liver damage, and so on, it would be the same process. Only in this case, we know that we get savings immediately, in addition to doing, from my perspective, what is the civilized thing, and that's making sure everybody gets housing.
The suffering you're seeing from a patient, though, doesn't tell you their whole backstory, doesn't tell you who else might deserve housing. How do you decide, first of all, which patient gets a house or a home?
Well, that's also a very good question. So about 20% of our homeless population meets these criteria, which is to say they are chronically homeless. Does that mean we don't want to take care of the other 80%? Of course we do. The challenge, however, is we have no resources. No state, no city, no county ever has adequate resources to do housing first, which is really what this is based on. Because, again, I reflect back on the numbers. When you have a huge number of dollars being consumed by a very small number of people, you just don't end up having the capacity. So by doing a program like this, by treating housing as health care, or in other words, homelessness as a medical condition, you open up so much more capacity. And I saw the huge amount of resource that was kind of going through people like me in the ER, where I see a patient, they call an ambulance, $800. They come to the ER, it's $1,200. If they have to have IV antibiotics for an infection, it's $2,000 more. That was like 3 months of service for that individual, and they got almost nothing out of me. So I just basically decided, take care of the hardest economic healthcare problem, and it opens up possibilities for everybody else.
But you could imagine someone saying, so I'm not in the emergency room, I'm not a meth addict, so I stay in the back of the line?
No, actually, we have several lines, of course, and I do appreciate the question. Please don't get me wrong. We have lines that work in other programs. For instance, we have not turned our back on any of the other programs that we do, like rental subsidies, state housing, Section 8 housing. So we're doing all of those things at the same time. But the truth is, at the moment, we don't have the political will in Hawaii or really anywhere across the country to greatly increase our budgets for the homeless, because the homeless end up being kind of an invisible political entity to people, which is really tragic. They're the people who really need us most. In my opinion, this is just one person's opinion, we're only as good a society as how well we take care of our greatest struggling class, and that's people who are homeless and on drugs and with mental illness. So we have to all come together for them.
Josh Green is an ER doctor and a Hawaii state senator. He wants doctors to essentially be able to prescribe housing. I'll bet you get some interest from other states.
I do. I got a terrific call letter from Rhode Island, leadership in Rhode Island. The Spanish government contacted me. The Canadian leadership contacted me. I've heard from people in New York already. I heard from people in Maine and Colorado. I think that this idea has legs. It's interesting because strange bedfellows have been made with this idea. On the one hand, the fiscal conservatives seem to like it because I've shown them the actual numbers, and they see that these savings are real. They're very real. Now, they may have an idea of what to do with the money once it's saved that's different from me, but they like the idea of a program that has a good return on investment. And then my social justice friends and family, like my dad in Seattle and my mom and everybody else that I usually hang out with, they really like the idea because from a social justice standpoint, we're talking about getting those who struggle among us the worst housing. I don't have all the answers, certainly. And this program, once it gets up and running, will have to be fit to each state and each city and each county differently. For instance, the Los Angeles folks called me and they love the idea as far as the plan to prescribe healthcare because doctors are so close to the problem, but they said they simply don't have any units. Same thing was in New York that could possibly be afforded with these numbers. What I told them was, well, you might have to retrofit schools that have been decommissioned or other public buildings to get that housing together because it would be more affordable. But at least you'd still start down the road of using your Medicaid dollars wisely. And I know that that's the case for Hawaii. We also have a housing crunch, and you know, I'm dealing with my housing folks on that. So each different locale would have to take this issue up with their own kind of signature amendments. But in an era where we're really questioning what government is, we're questioning what we're all about, I think this is kind of an idea that maybe its time has come.
ER Dr. Josh Green is a Democratic state senator in Hawaii, and his bill would let doctors prescribe housing for chronically homeless people. It has passed the Hawaii State Senate unanimously. It's on to the state house there, and if it passes, this housing prescription bill would be the first of its kind in the United States, and we'll watch its reception over here as we continue to propose solutions and talk pros and cons here on KUOW Seattle. In 200 years, it'll only be Chuck Berry. Sorry, Elvis. Rollover Beatles. Chuck Klosterman's going to tell you the news coming up here in about 10 minutes, so stay with us. I'm Bill Radke. Glad you've joined us today. Who caught the last fish you bought for dinner? If it came from Pacific Northwest waters, the fisherman was probably that, a man. Commercial fishing is still male-dominated in the Northwest. But KUOW's Tom Bonsi reports women's roles are evolving.
Sarah Scamzer has worked in or around commercial fishing for nearly her entire adult life. In her early 20s, she arrived on the Oregon coast and collected her first paychecks salmon fishing and crabbing in local waters. Then Scamzer asked for jobs on bigger boats, homeported in Newport, better pay and bigger adventure and all. But none of those skippers would hire her.
No, they said no. I know you could do the job. Gosh, you're probably stronger than me. I don't think my wife would like it. Or I would feel terrible if you got hurt on my boat.
This was in the early 1980s. To this day, in the Pacific Northwest, the dangerous work of hauling in the catch is overwhelmingly performed by men. Women hold fewer than 4% of the commercial fishery licenses issued by the Oregon and Washington State Departments of Fish and Wildlife. But pull back the lens a little bit, and there's evidence of change. Scamzer provided one of many oral histories that formed the basis of a research project on the role of women in the Northwest commercial fishing industry. Study co-author Flaxen Conway of Oregon State University says women are playing a larger role on the regulatory and business side.
I think that if you look at the scientists, you look at the processing, you look at the marketing. So once you broaden that out to fisheries in general, then you're really, I would absolutely say there's more women in science positions and management positions than there have been in my career, my 27-year-long career.
One of Conway's takeaways was that the traditional behind-the-scenes role of a fisherman's wife has become an increasingly complex and critical job. Tonette Dixon can vouch for that. She comes from a 4-generation fishing family in Newport. At a local coffee house, Dixon told me how she started in the family business by helping with net preparation at age 8. She went to sea in Alaska right after high school.
Being out there on the ocean was exciting. It matured me. It was a great experience.
In her early 20s, she got married.
He was a fisherman, which I said I would never marry.
Shortly before, Dixon turned down her grandfather's offer to run her own boat. Life at sea didn't fit with her vision of motherhood.
I wanted to have kids. And, you know, it's really hard unless you have a family boat. There is, like, there's tuna boats where families take their kids out, you know, during their season or seiners. But, you know, that wasn't what I was going to do.
Dixon remains deeply involved in the business. On shore, she manages the family's current 63-foot fishing boat, the payroll, bills, hiring and firing of crew, maintenance, and staying on top of the permits and quotas. She also serves as vice president of the Newport Fishermen's Wives organization. The nearly 50-year-old group now includes female scientists, boat owners, a fisheries attorney, and a hospital staffer. That frozen-out deckhand we met a few minutes ago, she has a seat at that table, too. Sarah Scamzer founded a successful fishing net and gear company with her husband, and she still deals with some of the fishermen who wouldn't hire her decades ago.
Bottom line of all of that is that I invoice those people now. And occasionally there's a large invoice, and I just look at them. I just give them the look like, probably should have hired me, would have gotten that for free. But
I'm Tom Bonsi in Newport, Oregon.
KUOW Seattle, I'm Bill Radke. Glad you're listening. Up and down the Puget Sound area, we're building light rail lines so you can zip around, out of traffic, get where you're going fast. well, relatively fast. What if there were a transit line that could get you to Portland in 15 minutes? That's the idea of a project called Pacific Hyperloop, and here to tell you about it from Seattle's tech news site, GeekWire. Welcome back, Alan Boyle.
Thank you, Bill.
Now, that is a high-speed rail line or a transit link. Tell us about Hyperloop.
Yeah, near supersonic, 760 miles an hour.
Yeah.
And it's an idea that Elon Musk, who founded SpaceX, came up with something like 3 or 4 years ago that would put you in a pneumatic tube, kind of like the Jetsons, and send you shooting off. His idea was to do it between LA and San Francisco. But there's a company called Hyperloop One that put together a global competition, and a lot of groups from a lot of different cities around the world applied. And now they've narrowed it down to 35 finalists, and the Seattle-Portland proposal is one of those finalists. And so they're going to go in. They're trying to whip up support for it. They've got an online petition that they want people to sign. Eventually, they hope to recruit officials and corporate backers to do it, but they're just getting started. And so it looks like there's a long road, so to speak, before this becomes a reality.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about reality just briefly. Pneumatic tube, 760 miles per hour. Does this seem like reality to you anytime? Well, you tell me, how far away? How seriously should I take this?
Well, actually, Hyperloop One is building a test track in the Nevada desert, and they're going to be testing this. And they say that they're going to be able to put this service in between Abu Dhabi and Dubai in 2020. So, but a lot of these things, it's 2 years away, and so, or 4 years away, and a lot of these things just stay 2 or 4 years away. So,
yes.
I think the proof is in the pudding.
And so, a pneumatic tube, Seattle to Portland. I want to picture it. Am I lying down in this tube?
You're kind of The concepts show people kind of half reclining, yeah. And actually, the concept that Hyperloop One has is very much like a high-speed rail experience where you're sitting at a table or sitting in a seat. So it would be like riding a train.
Elevated? In a tunnel?
Most of the concepts show it elevated. Actually, the first applications for it might be in moving cargo around ports, and that they even show it going beneath the ground and underwater. So it's a versatile concept in that way. And the reason why it may be so versatile is because it's still very theoretical.
I like that idea. Let the cargo go first.
Yeah.
How safe does this sound to you?
To me, I think it sounds suitably safe. I mean, it's going to be a few years before this.
Would you do it?
I would do it if it were done, because
would you let your child do it?
I would, but okay. That assumes that it goes through all the safety procedures that you have to do for this sort of thing. So if they just said, hey, we're going to build it like, putting two tin cans together and stringing a telephone line, I wouldn't do it that way. I would be reassured by the regulatory hoops that they'll have to jump through.
Talking about this Hyperloop competition, why are Seattle and Portland candidates? There are much bigger cities, of course.
That's true. So as I said, there are 35 cities, all around the world. Colorado has two proposals. The argument for Seattle and Portland is that you have a high-tech savvy clientele, and you have a corridor that would be very attractive for someone to put in something techie so that you could jet around from one startup in Portland to Seattle and see your backers in Vancouver, that sort of thing.
So especially given argument. Our traffic, there's a good argument.
Well,
you have
traffic.
Users who can't wait to go 7 miles per hour, much less 760.
Yeah, that's the response that we got to the story in GeekWire is people writing and saying, forget Seattle to Portland in 15 minutes. I want to get from Seattle to Bellevue in less than an hour.
Exactly. One more question, I think. If we are getting the technology to go Seattle-Portland in 15 minutes, does that mean light rail lines we're building are soon going to be obsolete?
No, there's a real spectrum of transit. Light rail for particular settings, shorter distances, that probably makes a lot more sense than Hyperloop. Hyperloop is good for that LA to San Francisco or Seattle to Portland distance. If you want to go farther, you're not going to build a Hyperloop from here to Chicago. You're going to take a plane.
Let's watch it together. Seattle's tech news website, GeekWire, and Alan Boyle. Thanks a lot, Alan.
Thank you.
It's KUOW Seattle.
Riding along in my automobile, my baby beside me at the wheel.
I don't suppose you were listening to Johnny B. Goode or Maybelline over the weekend, as I was. Chuck Berry has just died at age 90, and we are now going to convince you that he wasn't just a rebel, a songwriter, a showman. He was the rock and roller. My next guest argues that centuries from now, Chuck Berry will be the only rock and roll artist that most people can name. Chuck Klosterman, author of the book, But What If We're Wrong? Welcome back to KUOW.
Hey, it's great to be there.
The only rock and roller anyone can name. Why Chuck Berry?
Well, in my book, I kind of work from a strange premise, which is the idea that in 100 or 300 or 500 years, like all art forms, rock music will eventually become more of an academic pursuit. It will continue to recede from the culture, and it will be something that matters historically more than it sort of matters in a day-to-day way. So I sort of hypothesize about this classroom in some distant future, where one guy is trying to describe to the class why this musical form was so important in the last half of the 20th century. And in these situations, much like when we describe marching music, and we tend to use one person, John Philip Sousa, mm-hmm. to almost describe the entire genre, the same thing will happen to rock and roll.
I've heard that rock and roll will never die. Why are you assuming it's going to die like that?
Well, you know, that is a popular thing to say. They started saying it in 1969, I think, that rock music was never going to disappear. And, you know, they were right for a while, but there is nothing that doesn't disappear. There is no sort of cultural art form or extension of the culture that doesn't either radically change or just sort of slowly dissipate. I think it's pretty clear to anybody who follows rock music now that it's already aggressively receding from the culture. It's possible to imagine someone who's been listening to music for 10 years, you know, maybe they're 18 or whatever, and they have no memory of there being a new consequential rock record in their lifetime. So that seems to already be happening. Now, that doesn't mean it's going to die entirely, in the same way jazz has not died entirely. There are still practitioners of jazz. You can still find jazz on the radio. But it's not central to the culture, the way rock music was for so long. And it's beginning to become very clear that the same thing is happening to rock. So it is receding.
Okay, so let's accept that someday rock and roll will matter no more than John Philip Sousa's march music.
Yeah, it'll be something that people recognize, that people will know that it happened, but, you know, in this hypothetical class, the students will have no idea, who the Beatles were. They will have no relationship to Smells Like Teen Spirit. It'll be something that they maybe heard in a documentary 30 years ago.
But you're saying the Beatles will disappear and Chuck Berry will be the guy?
Okay, well, here's the thing. The most reasonable answer to what artist will sort of be the living memory of rock was, is the Beatles, okay? The Beatles make the most sense. But the fact of the matter is, what does history show us? History is sort of a collection of people being wrong about things. So I've worked from the premise that, okay, let's say it's not the Beatles. That's the obvious answer because they're the biggest group that ever existed. They're the most popular group that ever existed. But let's say it all disappears. So it's really just people who are trying to explain rock, not necessarily even enjoy it in a day-to-day way. They're the people, they're like the historian of the future, okay?
Mm-hmm.
The reason I think Chuck Berry might be the candidate over the Beatles is because when you start talking about almost a caricature of what rock music is, the tropes of what rock and roll is, all the qualities that we associate, if you ask someone, describe what makes music rock, it's almost like a fictional suit, right? And that suit perfectly fits Chuck Berry.
How's that?
You know, well, okay, so rock was simple blues-based music. You know, he made simple blues-based music. Rock comes from the South. He's from St. Louis. Rock was an art form that was kind of invented by black people and adopted by white people. Well, Chuck Berry influenced Keith Richards and Jimmy Page and all of these people. Rock music tends to have a very sexual overtone. Chuck Berry was a very sexual person. There's an outlaw quality to rock music. Chuck Berry was arrested many times and has sort of a very checkered past. All of the things that, if we were saying, well, what are the positive and negative things that we associate with this genre, they really kind of boil down to, you know, distill down to his personality. And beyond all that, he is also really the progenitor of this. I mean, the way he played guitar is sort of what rock guitar became. The length of his songs and the way that they are structured became what everyone adopted. So from a historical perspective. Not so much from an idea of who made the best music necessarily, but who made the music that seems to explain this concept. Chuck Berry seems like the guy.
That's interesting for a lot of reasons. For one, we have this idea that Elvis Presley was the biggest thief of all time because he sort of robbed history of rock and roll's black roots. And you're saying that's an illusion that's going to fade over time.
Well, you know, the thing about Elvis is he's a much bigger star than Chuck Berry ever was, but he didn't really write songs. There's very few songs in his entire catalog that Elvis Presley penned. He basically interpreted people's music, kind of like what Frank Sinatra does. And when we think about rock, we sort of assume that part of what makes it important is that it's an extension of the person who's performing it. Chuck Berry was a songwriter, and the way that he wrote these songs sort of described what the American South was at that time. So the creative aspect of Chuck Berry, the fact that not only did he play an early form of rock, but he actually came up with how the song is supposed to be organized and delivered, that's meaningful too. It's possible that Elvis will be penalized over time for not being the person who came up with the material he's most famous for.
And Chuck, do you see this process of history's winnowing already starting to happen? I ask you because I'm looking at the Washington Post headline, Chuck Berry, wild man of rock who helped define its rebellious spirit. And as you say, what is rock if it's not rebellious? The Guardian in England, Chuck Berry, the rock and roller who wrote the soundtrack for Teen Rebellion. Do you see history already starting toward making the judgment you're talking about?
Well, absolutely. And here's a clear example. Everyone talked about 2016, the huge number of deaths, okay, particularly in the world of rock music. You know, Prince and David Bowie. There seemed to be this mass number of people dying. But the question now becomes, when you're, say, at a magazine like Rolling Stone, who warrants a cover? Okay, whose death sort of demands that they become the cover of the magazine? George Michael died at Christmas. They did not put him on the cover. A decision had to be made because so many people had been dying and put on the cover of the publication that there now has to be certain cutoffs. If George Michael had died 2 years ago, he's absolutely on the cover. But because we had this avalanche of death, which is only going to increase, you're going to start seeing debates over how much weight a certain rock musician's demise really constitutes. Will Bill Wyman of the Rolling Stones get a cover of Rolling Stone magazine when he dies? You know, will that be justified? This is a question that used to not exist in the past, and now it's kind of everywhere.
You're not necessarily saying that Chuck Berry is the most important figure. In fact, Chuck Berry was responding to people around him and behind him, Louis Jordan and Howlin' Wolf and Muddy Waters and Bessie Smith and Big Mama Thornton. I mean, there's Little Richard in there and Jerry Lee Lewis. You're not saying it's all about Chuck Berry, but that's kind of the way we tend to decide things in retrospect.
Well, yeah, it's not all about anybody. I mean, if asked who was the most important artist within the realm of rock and roll, I would say the Beatles, but certainly I wouldn't say they were the only important one. Chuck Berry, though, probably becomes the closest candidate we have, though, to virtually everything in rock music that comes after him has some connection. This isn't to say that every artist built their career based on what he invented, but the things you're talking about that he sort of came out of, his influences, they're not going to be seen as part of the history of rock. We're going to start looking at the history of rock really starting in about 1950, and it's going to be him and Elvis and then the artists from the 60s and, you know, Little Richard and some of these people. There are just some certain cutoffs that we have to make if we're going to be historians.
Finally, Chuck, so historians may settle on one artist. It might be Chuck Berry. Will they settle on one song that defines rock and roll?
You know, that's a difficult question. It's possible that Chuck Berry could be the person, but not necessarily a song by him becomes the most lasting remnant, although I do think it's meaningful that in 1977, NASA sent a satellite into space, the Voyager, and it's still out there. Kind of shot past Pluto in 1990. And Carl Sagan sort of spearheaded this And one of the things he put on the Voyager was a solid gold record with also information on how to play this record. Now, this was supposed to include all the sounds of life. So it says the word hello in every known language. It has probably whale sounds and like the sounds of the jungle and all of these things. The assumption being if an alien found this, this would sort of illustrate what it was like to live on Earth. Well, the only rock song on there is Johnny Be Good by Chuck Berry. So, at least we will always know, no matter what happens to the Earth, that song will exist. I mean, even after the Earth is sort of swallowed by the sun, that song will be out there.
Deep down in Louisiana, close to New Orleans, way back up in the woods among the evergreens, there stood a log cabin made of earth and wood, where lived a country boy named Johnny B. Good, who never ever learned to read or write so well, but he could play a guitar just like a ring in a bell. Go, go.
You're listening to the writer Chuck Klosterman there, author of But What If We're Wrong? By the way, coming out in paperback next month.